said he would not be rebuffed. "You're sure?" Otto insisted. "I guarantee it." Walter said, "Father, may I have a word?" But the footman cried, "Herr Walter von Ulrich?" Walter hesitated, and his father said, "Your turn. Go on." Walter turned away and stepped into the throne room. The British liked to overawe their guests. The high-coffered ceiling had diamond-patterned coving. The red plush walls were hung with enormous portraits, and at the far end the throne was overhung by a high canopy with dark velvet drapes. In front of the throne stood the king in a naval uniform. Walter was pleased to see the familiar face of Sir Alan Tite at the king's side, no doubt whispering names in the royal ear. Walter approached and bowed. The king said, "Good to see you again, von Ulrich." Walter had rehearsed what he would say. "I hope your majesty found the discussion at Tŷ Gwyn interesting." "Very. Although the party was dreadfully overshadowed, of course, by the pit disaster. Indeed, so tragic. I look forward to our next meeting." Walter understood this was his dismissal. He walked backward, bowing repeatedly in the required manner, until he reached the doorway. His father was waiting for him in the next room. "That was quick," Walter said. "On the contrary, it took longer than normal," said Otto. "Usually the king says, 'I'm glad to see you in London,' and that's the end of the conversation." They left the palace together. "Admirable people, the British, in many ways, but soft," said Otto as they walked up St. James's Street to Piccadilly. "The king is ruled by his ministers. The ministers are subject to Parliament, and members of Parliament are chosen by the ordinary men. What sort of way is that to run a country?" Walter did not rise to that provocation. He believed that Germany's political system was out of date, with its weak Parliament that could not stand up to the Kaiser or the generals. But he had had that argument with his father many times, and besides, he was still worried by the conversation with the Mexican envoy. "What you said to Diaz was risky," he said. "President Wilson won't like us selling rifles to Huerta." "What does it matter what Wilson thinks? The danger is that we will make a friend of a weak nation, Mexico, by making an enemy of a strong nation, the United States. There's not going to be a war in America." Walter supposed that was true, but all the same he was uneasy. He did not like the idea of his country being at odds with the United States. In his apartment, they took off their antiquated costumes and dressed in tweed suits, with soft collared shirts and brown trilby hats. Back in Piccadilly, they boarded a motorized omnibus heading east. Otto had been impressed by Walter's invitation to meet the king at Tŷ Gwyn in January. "Earl Fitzherbert is a good connection," he had said. "If the Conservative Party comes to power, he may be a minister, perhaps foreign secretary one day. You must keep up the friendship." Walter had been inspired. "I should visit his charity clinic and make a small donation." "Excellent idea. Perhaps you would like to come with me." His father had taken the bait. "Even better." Walter had an ulterior motive, but his father was all unsuspecting. The bus took them past the theatres of the Strand, the newspaper offices of Fleet Street, and the banks of the financial district. Then the streets became narrower and dirtier. Top hats and bowlers were replaced by cloth caps. Horse-drawn vehicles predominated, and motor cars were few. This was the East End. They got off at Aldgate. Otto looked around disdainfully. "I didn't know you were taking me to the slums," he said. "We're going to a clinic for the poor," Walter replied. "Where would you expect it to be? Does Earl Fitzherbert himself come here? I suspect he just pays for it." Walter knew perfectly well that Fitz had never been there in his life, but he will, of course, hear about our visit. They zigzagged through back streets to a nonconformist chapel. A hand-painted wooden sign read, "Calvary Gospel Hall." Pinned to the board was a sheet of paper with the words, "Baby Clinic, free of charge, today and every Wednesday." Walter opened the door and they went in. Otto made a disgusted noise, then took out a handkerchief and held it to his nose. Walter had been there before, so he had been expecting the smell, but even so it was startlingly unpleasant. The hall was full of ragged women and half-naked children, all filthy dirty. The women sat on benches and the children played on the floor. At the far end of the room were two doors, each with a temporary label, one saying "Doctor" and the other "Patroness." Near the door sat Fitz's Aunt Herm, listing names in a book. Walter introduced his father. Lady Hermia Fitzherbert, my father, Herr Otto von Ulrich. At the other end of the room, the door marked Doctor opened, and a ragged woman came out carrying a tiny baby and a medicine bottle. A nurse looked out and said, "Next, please." Lady Hermia consulted her list and called, "Mrs. Blatsky and Rosie." An older woman and a girl went into the doctor's surgery. Walter said, "Wait here a moment, please, Father, and I'll fetch the boss." He hurried to the far end, stepping around the toddlers on the floor. He tapped on the door marked Patroness and walked in. The room was little more than a cupboard, and indeed there was a mop and bucket in a corner. Lady Maud Fitzherbert sat at a small table writing in a ledger. She wore a simple dove-grey dress and a broad-brimmed hat. She looked up, and the smile that lit up her face when she saw Walter was bright enough to bring tears to his eyes. She leaped out of her chair and threw her arms around him. He had been looking forward to this all day. He kissed her mouth, which opened to him immediately. He had kissed several women, but she was the only one he had ever known to press her body against him this way. He felt embarrassed, fearing that she would feel his erection, and he arched his body away. But she only pressed more closely, as if she really wanted to feel it. So he gave in to the pleasure. Maud was passionate about everything. Poverty, women's rights, music, and Walter. He felt amazed and privileged that she had fallen in love with him. She broke the kiss, panting. "Aunt Herm will become suspicious," she said. Walter nodded. "My father is outside." Maud patted her hair and smoothed her dress. "All right." Walter opened the door and they went back into the hall. Otto was chatting amiably to Hermia. He liked respectable old ladies. "Lady Maud Fitzherbert, may I present my father, Herr Otto von Ulrich?" Otto bowed over her hand. He had learned not to click his heels. The English thought it comical. Walter watched them size one another up. Maud smiled as if amused, and Walter guessed she was wondering if this was what he would look like in years to come. Otto took in Maud's expensive cashmere dress and the fashionable hat with approval. So far, so good. Otto did not know that they were in love. Walter's plan was that his father would get to know Maud first. Otto approved of wealthy women doing charitable work, and insisted that Walter's mother and his sister visit poor families at Zumwalt, their country estate in East Prussia. He would find out what a wonderful and exceptional woman Maud was. Then his defenses would be down by the time he learned that Walter wanted to marry her. It was a little foolish, Walter knew, to be so nervous. He was 28 years old. He had a right to choose the woman he loved. But 8 years ago he had fallen in love with another woman. Tilda had been passionate and intelligent, like Maud, but she was 17 and a Catholic. The von Ulrichs were Protestants. Both sets of parents had been angrily hostile to the romance, and Tilda had been unable to defy her father. Now Walter had fallen in love with an unsuitable woman for the second time. It was going to be difficult for his father to accept a feminist and a foreigner. But Walter was older and craftier now, and Maud was stronger and more independent than Tilda had been. All the same, he was terrified. He had never felt like this about a woman, not even Tilda. He wanted to marry Maud and spend his life with her. In fact, he could not imagine being without her, and he did not want his father to make trouble about it. Maud was on her best behavior. "It is very kind of you to visit us, Herr von Ulrich," she said. "You must be tremendously busy. For a trusted confidant of a monarch, as you are to your Kaiser, I imagine work has no end." Otto was flattered, as she had intended. "I'm afraid this is true," he said. "However, your brother, the Earl, is such a long-standing friend of Walter's that I was very keen to come. Let me introduce you to our doctor." Maud led the way across the room and knocked at the surgery door. Walter was curious. He had never met the doctor. "May we come in?" she called. They stepped into what must normally have been the pastor's office, furnished with a small desk and a shelf of ledgers and hymn books. The doctor, a handsome young man with black eyebrows and a sensual mouth, was examining Rosie Blatsky's hand. Walter felt a twinge of jealousy. Maud spent whole days with this attractive fellow. Maud said, "Dr. Greenwood, we have a most distinguished visitor. May I present Herr von Ulrich?" Otto said stiffly, "How do you do?" The doctor works here for no fee, Maud said. We're most grateful to him. Greenwood nodded curtly. Walter wondered what was causing the evident tension between his father and the doctor. The doctor returned his attention to his patient. There was an angry-looking cut across her palm, and the hand and wrist were swollen. He looked at the mother and said, "How did she do this?" The child answered, "My mother doesn't speak English," she said. "I cut my hand at work."
"And your father?"
"My father's dead."
Maud said quietly, "The clinic is for fatherless families, though in practice we never turn anyone away." Greenwood said to Rosie, "How old are you?"
11.
Walter murmured, "I thought children were not allowed to work under 13. "There are loopholes in the law," Maud replied. Greenwood said, "What work do you do?"
"I clean up at Manny Litsoff's garment factory. There was a blade in the sweepings."
"Whenever you cut yourself, you must wash the wound and put on a clean bandage. Then you have to change the bandage every day so that it doesn't get too dirty." Greenwood's manner was brisk, but not unkind. The mother barked a question at the daughter in heavily accented Russian. Walter could not understand her, but he got the gist of the child's reply, which was a translation of what the doctor had said. The doctor turned to his nurse. "Clean the hand and bandage it, please." To Rosie, he said, "I'm going to give you some ointment. If your arm swells more, you must come back and see me next week. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir."
"If you let the infection get worse, you may lose your hand." Tears came to Rosie's eyes. Greenwood said, "I'm sorry to frighten you, but I want you to understand how important it is to keep your hand clean." The nurse prepared a bowl of what was presumably antiseptic fluid. Walter said, "May I express my admiration and respect for your work here, doctor?" "Thank you. I'm happy to give my time, but we need to buy medical supplies. Any help you can offer will be much appreciated." Maud said, "We must leave the doctor to get on. There are at least 20 patients waiting." The visitors left the surgery. Walter was bursting with pride. Maud had more than compassion. When told of young children working in sweatshops, many aristocratic ladies could wipe away a tear with an embroidered handkerchief. But Maud had the determination and the nerve to give real help. And, he thought, she loves me. Maud said, "May I offer you some refreshment, Herr von Ulrich? My office is cramped, but I do have a bottle of my brother's best sherry." "Most kind, but we must be going." That was a bit quick, Walter thought. Maud's charm had stopped working on Otto. He had a nasty feeling that something had gone wrong. Otto took out his pocketbook and extracted a banknote. "Please accept a modest contribution to your excellent work here, Lady Maud." "How generous," she said. Walter gave her a similar note. "Perhaps I may be allowed to donate something, too." "I appreciate anything you can offer me," she said. Walter hoped he was the only one to notice the sly look she gave him as she said it. Otto said, "Please, be sure to give my respects to Earl Fitzherbert." They took their leave. Walter felt worried about his father's reaction. "Isn't Lady Maud wonderful?" he said breezily as they walked back toward Aldgate. "Fitz pays for everything, of course, but Maud does all the work."
"Disgraceful," Otto said. "Absolutely disgraceful."
Walter had sensed he was grumpy, but this astonished him. "What on earth do you mean? You approve of well-born ladies doing something to help the poor?
Visiting sick peasants with a few groceries in a basket is one thing," Otto said. "But I am appalled to see the sister of an earl in a place like that with a Jew doctor."
"Oh, God," Walter groaned. Of course, Dr. Greenwood was Jewish. His parents had probably been Germans called Grunwald. Walter had not met the doctor before today, and anyway might not have noticed or cared about his race. But Otto, like most men of his generation, thought such things important. Walter said, "Father, the man is working for nothing. Lady Maud cannot afford to refuse the help of a perfectly good doctor just because he's Jewish." Otto was not listening.
"Fatherless families. Where did she get that phrase?" he said with disgust. "The spawn of prostitutes is what she means."
Walter felt heartsick. His plan had gone horribly wrong.
"Don't you see how brave she is?"
he said miserably.
"Certainly not," said Otto. "If she were my sister, I'd give her a good thrashing."
2. There was a crisis in the White House. In the small hours of the morning of April 21st, Gus Duer was in the West Wing. This new building provided badly needed office space, leaving the original White House free to be used as a residence. Gus was sitting in the president's study near the Oval Office, a small, drab room lit by a dim bulb. On the desk was the battered Underwood portable typewriter used by Woodrow Wilson to write his speeches and press releases. Gus was more interested in the phone. If it rang, he had to decide whether to wake the president. A telephone operator could not make such a decision. On the other hand, the president's senior advisers needed their sleep. Gus was the lowliest of Wilson's advisers, or the highest of his clerks, depending on point of view. Either way, it had fallen to him to sit all night by the phone to decide whether to disturb the president's slumbers, or those of the First Lady, Ellen Wilson, who was suffering from a mysterious illness. Gus was nervous that he might say or do the wrong thing. Suddenly, all his expensive education seemed superfluous. Even at Harvard, there had never been a class in when to wake the president. He was hoping the phone would never ring. Gus was there because of a letter he had written. He had described to his father the royal party at Tí Gwen and the after-dinner discussion about the danger of war in Europe. Senator Duer had found the letter so interesting and amusing that he had shown it to his friend, Woodrow Wilson, who had said, "I'd like to have that boy in my office." Gus had been taking a year off between Harvard, where he had studied international law, and his first job at a Washington law firm. He had been halfway through a world tour, but he had eagerly cut short his travels and rushed home to serve his president. Nothing fascinated Gus so much as the relationships between nations, the friendships and hatreds, the alliances and the wars. As a teenager, he had attended sessions of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. His father was a member, and he had found it more fascinating than a play at the theatre. "This is how countries create peace and prosperity, or war, devastation, and famine," his father had said. "If you want to change the world, then foreign relations is the field in which you can do the most good, or evil." And now Gus was in the middle of his first international crisis. An overzealous Mexican government official had arrested 8 American sailors in the port of Tampico. The men had already been released. The official had apologized, and the trivial incident might have ended there. But the squadron commander, Admiral Mayo, had demanded a 21-gun salute. President Huerta had refused. Piling on the pressure, Wilson had threatened to occupy Veracruz, Mexico's biggest port. And so America was on the brink of war. Gus greatly admired the high-principled Woodrow Wilson. The president was not content with the cynical view that one Mexican bandit was pretty much like another. Huerta was a reactionary who had killed his predecessor, and Wilson was looking for a pretext to unseat him. Gus was thrilled that a world leader would say it was not acceptable for men to achieve power through murder. Would there come a day when that principle was accepted by all nations? The crisis had been cranked up a notch by the Germans. A German ship called the Ipiranga was approaching Veracruz with a cargo of rifles and ammunition for Huerta's government. Tension had been high all day, but now Gus was struggling to stay awake. On the desk in front of him, illuminated by a green shaded lamp, was a typewritten report from Army Intelligence on the strength of rebels in Mexico. Intelligence was one of the Army's smaller departments, with only 2 officers and 2 clerks, and the report was scrappy. Gus's mind kept wandering to Caroline Wigmore. When he arrived in Washington, he had called to see Professor Wigmore, one of his Harvard teachers who had moved to Georgetown University. Wigmore had not been at home, but his young second wife was there. Gus had met Caroline several times at campus events, and had been strongly drawn to her quietly thoughtful demeanor and her quick intelligence. "He said he needed to order new shirts," she said, but Gus could see the strain on her face. And then she added, "But I know he's gone to his mistress." Gus had wiped her tears with his handkerchief, and she had kissed his lips and said, "I wish I were married to someone trustworthy." Caroline had turned out to be surprisingly passionate. Although she would not allow sexual intercourse, they did everything else. She had shuddering orgasms when he did no more than stroke her. Their affair had been going on for only a month, but already Gus knew that he wanted her to divorce Wigmore and marry him. But she would not hear of it, even though she had no children. She said it would ruin Gus's career, and she was probably right. It could not be done discreetly, for the scandal would be too juicy. The attractive wife,
leaving a well-known professor and rapidly marrying a wealthy younger man. Gus knew exactly what his mother would say about such a marriage. It's understandable if the professor was unfaithful, but one can't meet the woman socially, of course. The president would be embarrassed, and so would the kind of people a lawyer wanted for clients. It would certainly put paid to any hopes Gus might have had of following his father into the Senate. Gus told himself he did not care. He loved Carolyn, and he would rescue her from her husband. He had plenty of money, and when his father died, he would be a millionaire. He would find some other career. Perhaps he might become a journalist, reporting from foreign capitals. All the same, he felt a stabbing pain of regret. He had just got a job in the White House, something young men dreamed of. It would be agonizingly hard to give that up, along with all it might lead to. The phone rang, and Gus was startled by its sudden jangling in the quiet of the West Wing at night. "Oh, my God," he said, staring at it. "Oh, my God, this is it." He hesitated several seconds, then at last picked up the handset. He heard the fruity voice of Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan. "I have Joseph Daniels on the line with me, Gus." Daniels was Secretary of the Navy, and the President's Secretary is listening on an extension. "Yes, Mr. Secretary, sir," said Gus. He made his voice calm, but his heart was racing. "Wake the President, please," said Secretary Bryan. "Yes, sir." Gus went through the Oval Office and out into the Rose Garden in the cool night air. He ran across to the old building. A guard let him in. He hurried up the main staircase and across the hall to the bedroom door. He took a deep breath and knocked hard, hurting his knuckles. After a moment, he heard Wilson's voice. "Who is it?" "Gus Dewar here, Mr. President," he called. "Secretary Bryan and Secretary Daniels are on the telephone."
"Just a minute."
President Wilson came out of the bedroom, putting on his rimless glasses, looking vulnerable in pajamas and a dressing gown. He was tall, though not as tall as Gus. At 57, he had dark grey hair. He thought he was ugly, and he was not far wrong. He had a beak of a nose and sticking-out ears, but the thrust of his big chin gave his face a determined look that accurately reflected the strength of character that Gus respected. When he spoke, he showed bad teeth.
"Good morning, Gus," he said amiably. "What's the excitement?"
"They didn't tell me."
"Well, you'd better listen in on the extension next door."
Gus hurried into the next room and picked up the phone. He heard Brian's sonorous tones.
"The Ipiranga is due to dock at 10 this morning."
Gus felt a thrill of apprehension. Surely the Mexican president would cave in now, otherwise there would be bloodshed. Brian read a cable from the American consul in Veracruz.
"Steamer Ipiranga, owned by Hamburg America Line, will arrive tomorrow from Germany with 200 machine guns and 15 million cartridges. We'll go to Pier 4 and start discharging at 10:30.
"Do you realize what this means, Mr. Bryan?" said Wilson, and Gus thought his voice sounded querulous.
"Daniels, are you there, Daniels? What do you think?"
Daniels replied, "The munitions should not be permitted to reach Huerta." Gus was surprised at this tough line from the peace-loving Navy secretary.
"I can write Admiral Fletcher to prevent it and take the customs house."
There was a long pause. Gus was gripping the phone so hard that his hand hurt. At last, the president spoke.
"Daniels, send this order to Admiral Fletcher. Take Veracruz at once."
"Yes, Mr. President," said the Navy Secretary.
And America was at war. 3. Gus did not go to bed that night or the following day. Shortly after 8:30, Secretary Daniels brought the news that an American warship had blocked the path of the Ipiranga. The German ship, an unarmed freighter, switched its engines to reverse and left the scene. American Marines would go ashore at Veracruz later that morning, Daniel said. Gus was dismayed by the rapidly developing crisis, but thrilled to be at the heart of things. Woodrow Wilson did not shrink from war. His favorite play was Shakespeare's Henry V, and he liked to quote the line, "If it be a sin to covet honor, I am the most offending soul alive." News came in by wireless and cable, and it was Gus's job to take the messages in to the president. At midday, the Marines took control of the Veracruz Customs House. Shortly afterward, he was told that there was someone to see him, a Mrs. Wigmore. Gus frowned worriedly. This was indiscreet. Something must be wrong. He hurried to the lobby. Carolyn looked distraught. Although she wore a neat tweed coat and a plain hat, her hair was untidy and her eyes red with crying. Gus was shocked and distressed to see her in this state.
"My darling," he said in a low voice, "what on earth has happened? This is the end,"
she said. "I can never see you again.
I'm so sorry."
She began to cry. Gus wanted to hug her, but he could not do so there. He had no office of his own. He looked around. The guard at the door was staring at them. There was nowhere they could be private. It was maddening.
"Come outside," he said, taking her arm. "We'll walk." She shook her head. "No, I'll be all right. Stay here."
"What has upset you?" She would not meet his eye and looked at the floor.
"I must be faithful to my husband. I have obligations. Let me be your husband."
She raised her face, and her yearning look broke his heart.
"Oh, how I wish I could."
"But you can.
I have a husband already.
He is not faithful to you. Why should you be to him?" She ignored that.
"He's accepted a chair at Berkeley. We're moving to California. Don't go. I've made up my mind."
"Obviously," Gus said flatly. He felt as if he had been knocked down. His chest hurt, and he found it hard to breathe.
"California,"
he said.
"Hell."
She saw his acceptance of the inevitable, and she began to recover her composure.
"This is our last meeting," she said.
"No,
please listen to me. There's something I want to tell you, and this is my only chance."
"All right."
"A month ago, I was ready to kill myself. Don't look at me like that, it's true. I thought I was so worthless that no one would ever care if I died. Then you appeared on my doorstep. You were so affectionate, so courteous, so thoughtful, that you made me think it was worth staying alive. You cherished me."
The tears were streaming down her cheeks, but she kept on.
"And you were so happy when I kissed you. If I could give someone that much joy, I couldn't be completely useless, I realized. And that thought kept me going. You saved my life, Gus. May God bless you."
He almost felt angry.
"What does that leave me with?" "Memories," she said. "I hope you will treasure them as I will treasure mine."
She turned away. Gus followed her to the door, but she did not look back. She went out, and he let her go. When she was out of sight, he headed automatically for the Oval Office, then changed direction. His mind was in too much of a turmoil for him to be with the president. He went into the men's room for a moment's peace. Fortunately, there was no one else there. He washed his face, then looked in the mirror. He saw a thin man with a big head. He was shaped like a lollipop. He had light brown hair and brown eyes and was not very handsome. But women usually liked him, and Carolyn loved him. Or she had, at least for a little while. He should not have let her go. How could he have watched her walk away like that? He should have persuaded her to postpone her decision, think about it, talk to him some more. Perhaps they could have thought of alternatives. But in his heart he knew there were no alternatives. She had already been through all that in her mind, he guessed. She must have lain awake nights, with her husband sleeping beside her, going over and over the situation. She had made up her mind before coming here. He needed to return to his post. America was at war. But how could he put this out of his mind? When he could not see her, he spent all day looking forward to the next time he could. Now he could not stop thinking about life without her. It already seemed a strange prospect. What would he do? A clerk came into the men's room and Gus dried his hands on a towel and returned to his station in the study next to the Oval Office. A few moments later, a messenger brought him a cable from the American consul in Veracruz. Gus looked at it and said, "Oh no." It read, "4 of our men killed, comma, 20 wounded, comma, firing all around the consulate, stop." 4 men killed, Gus thought with horror. 4 good American men with mothers and fathers and wives or girlfriends. The news seemed to put his sadness in perspective. At least, he thought, Carolyn and I are alive. He tapped on the door to the Oval Office and handed the cable to Wilson. The president read it and went pale. Gus looked keenly at him. How did he feel, knowing they were dead because of the decision he had made in the middle of the night? This was not supposed to happen. The Mexicans wanted freedom from tyrannical governments, didn't they? They should have welcomed the Americans as liberators. What had gone wrong? Brian and Daniels showed up a few minutes later, followed by the Secretary of War, Lindley Garrison, a man normally more belligerent than Wilson, and Robert Lansing, the State Department counselor. They gathered in the Oval Office to wait for more news. The President was wired tighter than a violin string. Pale, restless and twitchy, he paced the floor. It was a pity, Gus thought, that Wilson did not smoke. It might have calmed him. We all knew there might be violence, Gus thought, but somehow the reality is more shocking than we anticipated. More details came in sporadically, and Gus handed the messages to Wilson. The news was all bad. Mexican troops had resisted, firing on the Marines from their fort. The troops were supported by citizens who took potshots at Americans from their upstairs windows. In retaliation, the USS Prairie, anchored offshore, turned its 3-inch guns on the city and shelled it. Casualties mounted. 6 Americans killed. 8, 12, and more wounded. But it was a hopelessly unequal contest, and over 100 Mexicans died. The President seemed baffled. "We don't want to fight the Mexicans," he said. "We want to serve them if we can. We want to serve mankind." For the second time in a day, Gus felt knocked off his feet. The President and his advisers had had nothing but good intentions. How had things gone so wrong? Was it really so difficult to do good in international affairs? A message came from the State Department. The German ambassador, Count Johann von Bernstorff, had been instructed by the Kaiser to call on the Secretary of State and wished to know whether 9 o'clock tomorrow morning would be convenient. Unofficially, his staff indicated that the ambassador would be lodging a formal protest against the halting of the Ipiranga. "A protest?" said Wilson. "What the dickens are they talking about?" Gus saw immediately that the Germans had international law on their side. "Sir, there had been no declaration of war, nor of a blockade, so, strictly speaking, the Germans are correct." "What?" Wilson turned to Lansing. "Is that right?" "We'll double-check, of course," said the State Department counselor. "But I'm pretty sure Gus is right. What we did was contrary to international law." "So what does that mean?" "It means we'll have to apologize." "Never," said Wilson angrily. But they did. Four. Maud Fitzherbert was surprised to find herself in love with Walter von Ulrich. On the other hand, she would have been surprised to find herself in love with any man. She rarely met one she even liked. Plenty had been attracted to her, especially during her first season as a debutante, but most had quickly been repelled by her feminism. Others had planned to take her in hand, like the scruffy Marquis of Lowther, who had told Fitz that she would see the error of her ways when she met a truly masterful man. Poor Lowthy, he had been shown the error of his. Walter thought she was wonderful the way she was. Whatever she did, he marveled. If she espoused extreme points of view, he was impressed by her arguments. When she shocked society by helping unmarried mothers and their children, he admired her courage, and he loved the way she looked in daring fashions. Maud was bored by wealthy upper-class Englishmen who thought the way society was currently arranged was pretty satisfactory. Walter was different. Coming as he did from a conservative German family, he was surprisingly radical. From where she sat, in the back row of seats in her brother's box at the opera, she could see Walter in the stalls with a small group from the German embassy. He did not look like a rebel, with his carefully brushed hair, his trim mustache, and his perfectly fitting evening clothes. Even sitting down, he was upright and straight-shouldered. He looked at the stage with intense concentration, as Don Giovanni, accused of trying to rape a simple country girl, brazenly pretended to have caught his servant, Leporello, committing the crime. In fact, she mused, rebel was not the right word for Walter. Although unusually open-minded, Walter was sometimes conventional. He was proud of the great musical tradition of German-speaking people, and got cross with blasé London audiences for arriving late, chatting to their friends during the performance, and leaving early. He would be irritated at Fitz now for making comments about the soprano's figure to his pal Bing Westhampton, and at Bayer for talking to the Duchess of Sussex about Madame Lucille's shop in Hanover Square, where they bought their gowns. She even knew what Walter would say. They listen to the music only when they have run out of gossip. Maud felt the same, but they were in a minority. For most of London's high society, the opera was just one more opportunity to show off clothes and jewels. However, even they fell silent toward the end of Act One, as Don Giovanni threatened to kill Leporello, and the orchestra played a thunderstorm on drums and double basses. Then, with characteristic insouciance, Don Giovanni released Leporello and walked jauntily away, defying them all to stop him, and the curtain came down. Walter stood up immediately, looking toward the box, and waved. Fitz waved back. "That's von Ulrich," he said to Bing. "All those Germans are pleased with themselves because they embarrassed the Americans in Mexico." Bing was an impish, curly-haired Lothario, distantly related to the royal family. He knew little of world affairs, being mainly interested in gambling and drinking in the capital cities of Europe. He frowned and said in puzzlement, "What do the Germans care about Mexico?" "Good question," Fitz said. "If they think they can win colonies in South America, they're deceiving themselves. The United States will never allow it." Maud left the box and went down the grand staircase, nodding and smiling to acquaintances. She knew something like half the people there. London society was a surprisingly small set. On the red-carpeted landing, she encountered a group surrounding the slight, dapper figure of David Lloyd George, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. "Good evening, Lady Maud," he said with the twinkle that appeared in his bright blue eyes whenever he spoke to an attractive woman. "I hear your royal house party went well." He had the nasal accent of North Wales, less musical than the South Wales lilt. "But what a tragedy in the Aberdeen pit." "The bereaved families were much comforted by the King's condolences," Maud said. Among the group was an attractive woman in her 20s. Maud said, "Good evening, Miss Stevenson. How nice to see you again." Lloyd George's political secretary and mistress was a rebel, and Maud felt drawn to her. In addition, a man was always grateful to people who were polite to his mistress. Lloyd George spoke to the group. "That German ship delivered the guns to Mexico after all. It simply went to another port and quietly unloaded. So 19 American troops died for nothing. It's a terrible humiliation for Woodrow Wilson." Maud smiled and touched Lloyd George's arm. "Would you explain something to me, Chancellor?" "If I can, my dear," he said indulgently. Most men were pleased to be asked to explain things, especially to attractive young women, Maud found. She said, "Why does anyone care what happens in Mexico?"
"Oil, dear lady," Lloyd George replied. "Oil."
Someone else spoke to him, and he turned away. Maud spotted Walter. They met at the foot of the staircase. He bowed over her gloved hand, and she had to resist the temptation to touch his fair hair. Her love for Walter had awakened within her a sleeping lion of physical desire, a beast that was both stimulated and tormented by their stolen kisses and furtive fumbles.
"How are you enjoying the opera, Lady Maud?"
he said formally, but his hazel eyes said, "I wish we were alone."
"Very much. The Don has a wonderful voice. For me, the conductor goes a little too fast."
He was the only person she had ever met who took music as seriously as she did.
"I disagree," she said. "It's a comedy, so the melodies need to bounce along."
"But not just a comedy."
"That's true.
Perhaps he will slow down when things turn nasty in Act Two."
"You seem to have won some kind of diplomatic coup in Mexico," she said, changing the subject. "My father is..."
He searched for words, something that was unusual for him.
"Cock-a-hoop,"
he said after a pause.
"And you are not?"
He frowned.
"I worry that the American president may want to get his own back one day."
At that moment, Fitz walked past and said, "Hello, von Ulrich. Come and join us in our box. We've got a spare seat."
"With pleasure," said Walter.
Maud was delighted. Fitz was just being hospitable. He did not know his sister was in love with Walter. She would have to bring him up to date soon. She was not sure how he would take the news. Their countries were at odds, and although Fitz regarded Walter as a friend, that was a long step from welcoming him as a brother-in-law. She and Walter walked up the stairs and along the corridor. The back row in Fitz's box had only two seats with a poor view. Without discussion, Maud and Walter took those seats. A few minutes later, the house lights went down. In the half-dark, Maud could almost imagine herself alone with Walter. The second act began with the duet between the Don and Leporello. Maud liked the way Mozart made masters and servants sing together, showing the complex and intimate relationships between upper and lower orders. Many dramas dealt only with the upper classes, and portrayed servants as part of the furniture, as many people wished they were. Bea and the Duchess returned to the box during the trio Artacci in giusto core. Everyone seemed to have exhausted the available topics of conversation, for they talked less and listened more. No one spoke to Maud or Walter, or even turned to look at them, and Maud wondered excitedly whether she might take advantage of the situation. Feeling daring, she reached out and furtively took Walter's hand. He smiled and stroked her fingers with the ball of his thumb. She wished she could kiss him, but that would be foolhardy. When Zelina sang her aria, Vedrai Carino, in sentimental 3/8 time, an irresistible impulse tempted Maud, and as Zelina pressed Masetto's hand to her heart, Maud laid Walter's hand on her breast. He gave an involuntary gasp, but no one noticed because Masetto was making similar noises, having just been beaten up by the Don. She turned his hand so that he could feel her nipple with his palm. He loved her breasts and touched them whenever he could, which was seldom. She wished it were oftener. She loved it. This was another discovery. Other people had stroked them. A doctor, an Anglican priest, an older girl at dancing class, a man in a crowd, and she had been disturbed and at the same time flattered at the thought that she could arouse people's lust, but she had never enjoyed it until now. She glanced at Walter's face and saw that he was staring at the stage, but there was a glint of perspiration on his forehead. She wondered if she was wrong to excite him in this way, when she could not give him satisfaction. But he made no move to withdraw his hand, so she concluded that he liked what she was doing. So did she, but as always she wanted more. What had changed her? She had never been like this. It was him, of course, and the connection she felt with him, an intimacy so intense that she felt she could say anything, do whatever she liked, suppress nothing. What made him so different from every other man who had ever taken a fancy to her? A man such as Louthy, or even Bing, expected a woman to act like a well-behaved child, to listen respectfully when he was being ponderous, to laugh appreciatively at his wit, to obey when he was masterful, and to give him a kiss whenever he asked. Walter treated her as a grown-up. He did not flirt or condescend or show off, and he listened at least as much as he talked. The music turned sinister as the statue came to life, and the Commendatore stalked into the Don's dining room to a discord that Maud recognized as a diminished seventh. This was the dramatic high point of the opera, and Maud was almost certain no one would look around. Perhaps she could give Walter satisfaction after all, she thought, and the idea made her breathless. As the trombones blared over the deep bass voice of the Commendatore, she placed her hand on Walter's thigh. She could feel the warmth of his skin through the fine wool of his dress trousers. Still, he did not look at her, but she could see that his mouth was open and he was breathing heavily. She slid her hand up his thigh and, as the Don bravely took the Commendatore's hand, she found Walter's stiff penis and grasped it. She was excited and, at the same time, curious. She had never done this before. She explored it through the fabric of his trousers. It was bigger than she expected, and harder, too, more like a piece of wood than part of the body. How strange, she thought, that such a remarkable physical change should occur just because of a woman's touch. When she was aroused, it showed in tiny changes, that almost imperceptible feeling of puffiness and the dampness inside. For men, it was like raising a flag. She knew what boys did, for she had spied on Fitz when he was 15, and now she imitated the action she had seen him perform, the up-and-down movement of the hand, while the Commendatore called upon the Don to repent, and the Don repeatedly refused. Walter was panting now, but no one could hear because the orchestra was so loud. She was overjoyed that she could please him so much. She watched the backs of the heads of the others in the box, terrified that one of them might look round, but she was too caught up in what she was doing to stop. Walter covered her hand with his own, teaching her how to do it, gripping harder on the downstroke and releasing the pressure on the up, and she imitated what he did. As the Don was dragged into the flames, Walter jerked in his seat. She felt a kind of spasm in his penis, once, twice, and a third time, and then, as the Don died of fright, Walter seemed to slump, exhausted. Maud suddenly knew that what she had done was completely mad. She quickly withdrew her hand. She flushed with shame. She found she was panting and tried to breathe normally. The final ensemble began on stage and Maud relaxed. She did not know what had possessed her, but she had got away with it. The release of tension made her want to laugh. She suppressed a giggle. She caught Walter's eye. He was looking at her with adoration. She felt a glow of pleasure. He leaned over and put his lips to her ear.
Thank you,
he murmured. She sighed and said, It was a pleasure. Chapter 6 June 1914 At the beginning of June, Grigory Peshkov at last had enough money for a ticket to New York. The Vyalov family in St. Petersburg sold him both the ticket and the papers necessary for immigration into the United States, including a letter from Mr. Joseph Vyalov in Buffalo, promising to give Grigory a job. Grigory kissed the ticket. He could hardly wait to leave. It was like a dream, and he was afraid he might wake up before the boat sailed. Now that departure was so close, he longed even more for the moment when he would stand on deck and look back to watch Russia disappear over the horizon and out of his life forever. On the evening before his departure, his friends organized a party. It was held at Mishka's, a bar near the Putilov Machine Works. There were a dozen workmates, most of the members of the Bolshevik discussion group on socialism and atheism, and the girls from the house where Grigory and Lev lived. They were all on strike. Half the factories in St. Petersburg were on strike, so no one had much money, but they clubbed together and bought a barrel of beer and some herrings. It was a warm summer evening, and they sat on benches in a patch of waste ground next to the bar. Grigory was not a great party lover. He would have preferred to spend the evening playing chess. Alcohol made people stupid, and flirting with other men's wives and girlfriends just seemed pointless. His wild-haired friend, Konstantin, the chairman of the discussion group, had a row about the strike with aggressive Isaac, the footballer, and they ended up in a shouting match. Big Varya, Konstantin's mother, drank most of a bottle of vodka, punched her husband, and passed out. Lev brought a crowd of friends, men Grigory had never met, and girls he did not want to meet, and they drank all the beer without paying for anything. Grigory spent the evening staring mournfully at Katerina. She was in a good mood. She loved parties. Her long skirt whirled and her blue-green eyes flashed as she moved around, teasing the men and charming the women, that wide, generous mouth always smiling. Her clothes were old and patched, but she had a wonderful body, the kind of figure Russian men loved, with a full bust and broad hips. Grigory had fallen in love with her on the day he had met her, and he was still in love 4 months later. But she preferred his brother. Why? It had nothing to do with looks. The two brothers were so alike that people sometimes mistook one for the other. They were the same height and weight, and could wear each other's clothes. But Lev had charm by the ton. He was unreliable and selfish, and he lived on the edge of the law, but women adored him. Grigory was honest and dependable, a hard worker and a serious thinker, and he was single. It would be different in the United States. Everything would be different there. American landowners were not allowed to hang their peasants. American people had to put people on trial before punishing them. The government could not even jail socialists. There were no noblemen. Everyone was equal, even Jews. Could it be real? Sometimes America seemed too much of a fantasy, like the stories people told of South Seas Islands, where beautiful maidens gave their bodies to anyone who asked. But it must be true. Thousands of emigrants had written letters home. At the factory, a group of revolutionary socialists had started a series of lectures on American democracy, but the police had closed them down. He felt guilty about leaving his brother behind, but it was the best way. Look after yourself, he said to Lev toward the end of the evening. I won't be here to get you out of trouble any more. I'll be fine, Lev said carelessly. You look after yourself. I'll send you the money for your ticket. It won't take long on American wages. I'll be waiting. Don't move house. We could lose touch. I'm not going anywhere, big brother. They had not discussed whether Katerina too would eventually come to America. Grigory had left it to Lev to raise the subject, but he had not. Grigory did not know whether to hope or dread that Lev would want to bring her. Lev took Katerina's arm and said, We have to go now. Grigory was surprised. Where are you off to at this time of night? I'm meeting Trofim. Trofim was a minor member of the Vyalov family. Why do you have to see him tonight? Lev winked. Never mind. We'll be back before morning, in plenty of time to take you to Gutuyevsky Island. This was where the transatlantic steamers docked. All right, said Grigory. Don't do anything dangerous, he added, knowing it was pointless. Lev waved gaily and disappeared. It was almost midnight. Grigory said his goodbyes. Several of his friends wept, but he did not know whether it was from sorrow or just booze. He walked back to the house with some of the girls, and they all kissed him in the hall. Then he went to his room. His second-hand cardboard suitcase stood on the table. Though small, it was half empty. He was taking shirts, underwear, and his chess set. He had only one pair of boots. He had not accumulated much in the 9 years since his mother died. Before going to bed, he looked in the cupboard where Lev kept his revolver, a Belgian-made Nagant MI-895. He saw, with a sinking feeling, that the gun was not in its usual place. He unlatched the window so that he would not have to get out of bed to open it when Lev came in. Lying awake, listening to the familiar thunder of passing trains, he wondered what it would be like, 4,000 miles from here. He had lived with Lev all his life, and he had been a substitute mother and father. From tomorrow he would not know when Lev was out all night and carrying a gun. Would it be a relief, or would he worry more? As always, Grigori woke at 5. His ship sailed at 8, and the dock was an hour's walk. He had plenty of time. Lev had not come home. Grigori washed his hands and face. Looking in a broken shard of mirror, he trimmed his mustache and beard with a pair of kitchen scissors. Then he put his best suit on. He would leave his other suit behind for Lev. He was heating a pan of porridge on the fire when he heard a loud knocking at the door of the house. It was sure to be bad news. Friends stood outside and shouted. Only the authorities knocked. Grigori put on his cap, then stepped into the hall and looked down the staircase. The landlady was admitting 2 men in the black and green uniforms of the police. Looking more carefully, Grigori recognized the podgy moon-shaped face of Mikhail Pinsky and the small rat-like head of his sidekick, Ilya Koslov. He thought fast. Obviously someone in the house was suspected of a crime. The likeliest culprit was Lev. Whether it was Lev or another boarder, everyone in the building would be interrogated. The 2 cops would remember the incident back in February when Grigori had rescued Katerina from them, and they would seize the opportunity of arresting Grigori. And Grigori would miss his ship. The dreadful thought paralyzed him, to miss the ship. After all the saving and waiting and longing for this day, no, he thought, no, I won't let it happen. He ducked back into his room as the 2 policemen started up the stairs. It would be no use to plead with them, quite the reverse. If Pinsky discovered that Grigori was about to emigrate, he would take even more pleasure in keeping him incarcerated. Grigori would not even have a chance to cash his ticket and get the money back. All those years of saving would be wasted. He had to flee. He scanned the tiny room frantically. It had 1 door and 1 window. He would have to go out the way Lev came in at night. He looked out. The backyard was empty. The St. Petersburg police were brutal, but no one had ever accused them of being smart, and it had not occurred to Pinsky and Koslov to cover the rear of the house. Perhaps they knew there was no exit from the yard except across the railway. But a railway line was not much of a barrier to a desperate man. Grigori heard shouts and cries from the girl's room next door. The police had gone there first. He patted the breast of his jacket. His ticket, papers and money were in his pocket. All the rest of his worldly possessions were already packed in the cardboard suitcase. Picking up his suitcase, he leaned as far as he could out of the window. He held the case out and threw it. It landed flat and seemed undamaged. The door of his room burst open. Grigori put his legs through the window, sat on the sill for a split second, then jumped to the roof of the washhouse. His feet slipped on the tiles and he sat down hard. He slid down the sloping roof to the gutter. He heard a shout behind him, but he did not look back. He jumped from the washhouse roof to the ground and landed unhurt. He picked up his suitcase and ran. A shot rang out, scaring him into running faster. Most policemen could not hit the Winter Palace from 3 yards, but accidents sometimes happened. He scrambled up the railway embankment, conscious that as he climbed to the level of the window, he was becoming an easier target. He heard the distinctive thud and gasp of a railway engine, and looked to his right to see a goods train approaching fast. There was another shot, and he sensed a thump somewhere, but he felt no pain and guessed the slug had hit his suitcase. He reached the top of the embankment, knowing his body was now outlined against the clear morning sky. The train was a few yards away. The driver sounded his klaxon loud and long. A 3rd shot rang out. Grigori threw himself across the line just ahead of the train. The locomotive howled past him, steel wheels clashing with steel rails, steam trailing as the klaxon faded. Grigori scrambled to his feet. Now he was shielded from gunfire by a train of open trucks loaded with coal. He ran across the remaining tracks. As the last of the coal wagons passed, he descended the far embankment and walked through the yard of a small factory into the street. He looked at his suitcase. There was a bullet hole in one edge. It had been a near miss. He walked briskly, catching his breath, and asked himself what he should do next. Now that he was safe, at least for the moment, he began to worry about his brother. He needed to know whether Lev was in trouble, and if so, what kind. He decided to start in the last place he had seen Lev, which was Mishka's bar. As he headed for the bar, he felt nervous about being spotted. It would be bad luck, but it was not impossible. Pinsky might be roaming the streets. He pulled his cap down over his forehead, not really believing it would disguise his identity. He came across some workers heading for the docks, and attached himself to the group. But with his suitcase, he did not look as if he belonged. However, he reached Mishka's without incident. The bar was furnished with homemade wooden benches and tables. It smelled of last night's beer and tobacco smoke. In the morning, Mishka served bread and tea to people who had nowhere at home to make breakfast, but business was slow because of the strike, and the place was almost empty. Grigori intended to ask Mishka if he knew where Lev had been headed when he left, but before he could do so, he saw Katerina. She looked as if she had been up all night. Her blue-green eyes were bloodshot, her fair hair was awry, and her skirt was crumpled and stained. She was visibly distressed, with shaking hands and tear streaks on her grimy cheeks. Yet that made her more beautiful to Grigori, and he longed to take her in his arms and comfort her. Since he could not, he would do the next best thing and come to her aid.
"What's happened?" he said. "What's the matter?" "Thank God you're here," she said. "The police are after Lev."
Grigori groaned. So his brother was in trouble, today, of all days.
"What has he done?"
Grigori did not bother to consider the possibility that Lev was innocent.
"There was a mess-up last night. We were supposed to unload some cigarettes from a barge."
They would be stolen cigarettes, Grigori assumed. Katerina went on. "Lev paid for them. Then the bargeman said it wasn't enough money, and there was an argument. Someone started shooting. Lev fired back. Then we ran away.
Thank heaven neither of you got hurt. Now we don't have the cigarettes or the money."
"What a mess." Grigori looked at the clock over the bar. It was 6:15. He still had plenty of time.
"Let's sit down. Do you want some tea?"
He beckoned to Mishka and asked for 2 glasses of tea.
"Thank you," said Katerina. "Lev thinks one of the wounded must have talked to the police. Now they're after him."
"And you?"
"I'm all right. No one knows my name."
Grigori nodded.
"So what we have to do is keep Lev out of the hands of the police. He'll have to lie low for a week or so, then slip out of St. Petersburg." "He hasn't got any money."
"Of course not." Lev never had any money for essentials, though he could always buy drinks, place a bet, and entertain girls.
"I can give him something."
Grigori would have to dip into the money he had saved for the journey.
"Where is he?" "He said he would meet you at the ship."
Mishka brought their tea. Grigori was hungry. He had left his porridge on the fire, and he asked for some soup. Katerina said,
"How much can you give Lev?"
She was looking earnestly at him, and that always made him feel he would do anything she asked. He looked away.
"Whatever he needs," he said. "You're so good."
Grigori shrugged. "He's my brother."
"Thank you."
It pleased Grigori when Katerina was grateful, but it embarrassed him too. The soup came and he began to eat, glad of the diversion. The food made him feel more optimistic. Lev was always in and out of trouble. He would slip out of this difficulty as he had many times before. It did not mean Grigori had to miss his sailing. Katerina watched him, sipping her tea. She had lost the frantic look. "Lev puts you in danger," Grigori thought, "and I come to the rescue, yet you prefer him." Lev was probably at the dock now, skulking in the shadow of a derrick, nervously looking out for a policeman as he waited. Grigori needed to get going. But he might never see Katerina again, and he could hardly bear the thought of saying goodbye to her forever. He finished his soup and looked at the clock. It was 7:00. He was cutting things too fine.
"I have to go," he said reluctantly.
Katerina walked with him to the door.
"Don't be too hard on Lev," she said.
"Was I ever?" She put her hands on his shoulders, stood on tiptoe, and kissed him briefly on the lips.
"Good luck," she said.
Grigori walked away. He went quickly through the streets of southwest St. Petersburg. an industrial quarter of warehouses, factories, storage yards, and overcrowded slums. The shameful impulse to weep left him after a few minutes. He walked on the shady side, kept his cap low and his head down, and avoided wide-open areas. If Pinsky had circulated a description of Lev, an alert policeman might easily arrest Grigori. But he reached the docks without being spotted. His ship, the Angel Gabriel, was a small rusty vessel that took both cargo and passengers. Right now it was being loaded with stoutly nailed wooden packing cases marked with the name of the city's largest fur trader. As he watched, the last box went into the hold, and the crew fastened the hatch. A family of Jews were showing their tickets at the head of the gangplank. All Jews wanted to go to America, in Grigori's experience. They had even more reason than he did. In Russia, there were laws forbidding them to own land, to enter the civil service, to be army officers, and countless other prohibitions. They could not live where they liked, and there were quotas limiting the number who could go to universities. It was a miracle any of them made a living, and if they did prosper against the odds, it would not be long before they were set upon by a crowd, usually egged on by policemen such as Pinsky, and beaten up, their families terrified, their windows smashed, their property set on fire. The surprise was that any of them stayed. The ship's hooter sounded for all aboard. He could not see his brother. What had gone wrong? Had Lev changed plans again, or had he been arrested already? A small boy tugged at Grigori's sleeve.
"A man wants to talk to you,"
the boy said.
"What man?" "He looks like you."
"Thank God," thought Grigori.
"Where is he?" "Behind the planks."
There was a stack of timber on the dock. Grigori hurried around it and found Lev hiding behind it, nervously smoking a cigarette. He was fidgety and pale, a rare sight, but he usually remained cheerful even in adversity.
"I'm in trouble," Lev said. "Again. Those bargemen are liars. And thieves, probably. Don't get sarcastic with me. There isn't time." "No, you're right. We need to get you out of town until the fuss dies down."
Lev shook his head in negation, blowing out smoke at the same time.
"One of the bargemen died. I'm wanted for murder." "Oh, hell."
Grigori sat down on a shelf of timber and buried his head in his hands.
"Murder," he said. "Trofim was badly wounded, and the police got him to talk. He fingered me. How do you know all this?" "I saw Fyodor half an hour ago."
Fyodor was a corrupt policeman of Lev's acquaintance.
"This is bad news. There's worse. Pinsky has vowed to get me, as revenge on you."
Grigori nodded.
"That's what I was afraid of. What am I going to do?" "You'll have to go to Moscow. St. Petersburg won't be safe for you for a long time, maybe forever."
"I don't know that Moscow is far enough, now that the police have telegraph machines."
He was right, Grigori realized. The ship's hooter sounded again. Soon the gangplanks would be withdrawn.
"We only have a minute left," said Grigori. "What are you going to do?"
Lev said, "I could go to America."
Grigori stared at him. Lev said,
"You could give me your ticket."
Grigori did not want even to think about it. But Lev went on with remorseless logic.
"I could use your passport and papers for entering the United States. No one would know the difference."
Grigori saw his dream fading, like the ending of a motion picture at the Soleil Cinema in Nevsky Prospect, when the house lights came up to show the drab colors and dirty floors of the real world.
"Give you my ticket,"
he repeated, desperately postponing the moment of decision.
"You'd be saving my life," Lev said.
Grigori knew he had to do it, and the realization was like a pain in his heart. He took the papers from the pocket of his best suit and gave them to Lev. He handed over all the money he had saved for the journey. Then he gave his brother the cardboard suitcase with the bullet hole.
"I'll send you the money for another ticket," Lev said fervently.
Grigori made no reply, but his skepticism must have shown on his face, for Lev protested,
"I really will. I swear it. I'll save up."
"All right," Grigori said. They embraced. Lev said,
"You always took care of me."
"Yes, I did."
Lev turned and ran for the ship. The sailors were untying the ropes. They were about to pull up the gangplank, but Lev shouted and they waited a few seconds more for him. He ran up onto the deck. He turned, leaned on the rail, and waved to Grigori. Grigori could not bring himself to wave back. He turned and walked away. The ship hooted, but he did not look back. His right arm felt strangely light without the burden of the suitcase. He walked through the docks, looking down at the deep black water, and the odd thought occurred to him that he could throw himself in. He shook himself. He was not prey to such foolish ideas. All the same, he was depressed and bitter. Life never dealt him a winning hand. He was unable to cheer himself up as he retraced his steps through the industrial district. He walked along with his eyes cast down, not even bothering to keep an eye open for the police. It hardly mattered if they arrested him now. What was he going to do? He felt he could not summon the energy for anything. They would give him back his job at the factory when the strike was over. He was a good worker, and they knew it. He should probably go there now and find out whether there had been any progress in the dispute, but he could not be bothered. After an hour, he found himself approaching Mishka's. He intended to go straight past, but glancing inside, he saw Katerina sitting where he had left her 2 hours ago, with a cold glass of tea in front of her. He had to tell her what had happened. He went inside. The place was empty except for Mishka, who was sweeping the floor. Katerina stood up, looking scared.
"Why are you here?" she said. "Did you miss your boat?"
"Not exactly." He could not think how to break the news.
"What then?"
she said.
"Is Lev dead?"
"No. He's all right. But he's wanted for murder." She stared at him.
"Where is he?"
"He had to go away."
"Where?"
There was no gentle way to put it.
"He asked me to give him my ticket." "Your ticket?"
"And passport. He's gone to America."
"No!"
she screamed. Grigori just nodded.
"No!"
she yelled again.
"He wouldn't leave me! Don't you say that! Never say it!
Try to stay calm." She slapped Grigori's face. She was only a girl, and he hardly flinched.
"Swine!"
she screeched.
"You've sent him away!"
"I did it to save his life."
"Bastard! Dog! I hate you! I hate your stupid face!"
"Nothing you say could make me feel any worse," Grigori said, but she was not listening. Ignoring her curses, he walked away, her voice fading as he went out through the door. The screaming stopped, and he heard footsteps running along the street after him.
"Stop!" she cried. "Stop! Please, Grigori, don't turn your back on me. I'm so sorry."
He turned.
"Grigori, you have to look after me now that Lev's gone."
He shook his head. "You don't need me. The men of this city will form a queue to look after you."
"No, they won't,"
she said.
"There's something you don't know."
Grigori thought, "What now?" She said,
"Lev didn't want me to tell you."
"Go on."
"I'm expecting a baby,"
she said, and she began to weep. Grigori stood still, taking it in. Lev's baby, of course. And Lev knew. Yet he had gone to America.
"A baby?"
Grigori said. She nodded, crying. His brother's child, his nephew or niece, his family. He put his arms around her and drew her to him. She was shaking with sobs. She buried her face in his jacket. He stroked her hair.
"All right," he said. "Don't worry. You'll be okay. So will your baby."
He sighed.